From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made sometime in the 1970s when the late and great Fred Rogers said the following, quote, "Play is often talked about as if it were a relief from serious learning. But for children, play is serious learning. Play is really the work of childhood," end quote. So I wonder what Fred Rogers would think about the growing list of American schools that have cut or eliminated recess, or about the children who so often have no free playtime, each hour of their day structured by sports or music, or sports and then music and then sports, and parents concerned about making sure there's always structure. Well, on this program, we've talked about schools cutting back on play, but what about those who are trying to go the other way? An upcoming conference is designed to spotlight the value of play to a child's development, and that is our focus for this hour. With my guests, Bill Calla is a former superintendent of a number of districts, probably known from Fairport. He's also on the board of something called Generation 2. It's nice to see you here, Bill. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What's the short definition for what Generation 2 is, Bill? Well, you're going to Bill's immediately turning to the official founder, and that's Dr. Bruce Gilbert, who's also here. Dr. Gilbert, nice to have you.
It's good to be here.
Generation 2 is what?
Well, I think that we can call Generation 2 embracing the power of three: civic engagement, school-based child-centered play and conversation, and child advocacy. And the tool that we use is child-centered play. And we advocate for the play based on teaching volunteers to observe children, listen to them, communicate a significant amount of empathy and caring. And the children, in a sense, direct the show. They come in for a half an hour, they play, our volunteers listen, and learn.
And play with them.
The play is meant to be fun-making. It's a little messy at times. It's experimental. And it is truly the foundation for creativity. And it is truly a type of experience that promotes intrinsic motivation to learn about many things. Not just learning about their senior friends or their college friends, but also a lot about themselves. There's a feeling based on the empathy that they belong. And the beauty of the play is there are no dire consequences. It's not meant to be productive. It's not meant to acquire a specific skill. It's meant to experience the joy of exploring who a child is and who their friend is.
Melanie Morose is here as well. She's the executive director of Generation 2. It's nice to see you here, Melanie.
Thank you.
We got a lot to talk about when it comes to play this hour, and we want to tell you that there's an upcoming event, Generation 2 presenting the 9th Annual Urban Suburban Conference, Play Equals Learning Equals Play. That's this coming Wednesday from 9 to noon at the Strong National Museum of Play, and Debbie McCoy, who is the Assistant Vice President for Education at the Strong, is going to be the keynote speaker at that event. And Dr. Cal is going to be out there, Dr. Gilbert, among many others. So 9 to noon, and if you want to get involved, you can contact Bruce Gilbert. He's easy to find, BruceGilbert@gmail.com. The phone number to call if you want to sign up for the Play Conference, the Play Equals Learning Conference, this coming Wednesday. The number is 585-244-5970, 585-244-5970. Bill, I have to start at a place that I feel like every time I've talked to you in the last couple of years, we've talked about standardized testing. And we're talking about play today, so it's not supposed to be about standardized testing. But one thing that comes up whenever we talk about play on this program is we hear from parents or teachers who tell us, well, you know, kids are being pushed to get ready for tests, even at the first grade level, even at kindergarten. We saw a new study earlier this year that came out that said the whole 10 minutes grade level of homework rule is generally being exceeded in many places across this country. And so what do you cut? Well, maybe you cut recess. Maybe you cut different parts of the day that normally for young kids would be set aside for play or unstructured time. That this idea of college prep, even at a young age, is part of the game now. Do you see that? I mean, how would you?
Oh, it's definitely part of the game. It's an insidious part of the game, and it's wrongheaded. If anything needs to be cut, these are the kinds of things that need to be cut. Test prep does not belong in K-2 at all. Test prep, you can argue, doesn't belong anywhere as it exists right now. We need to be looking at play-based curriculum K-2. That's the emphasis that I've been placing on early childhood education for my entire life, and especially in the past couple of years at Fairport. We've made a very strong movement towards Reggio Emilia, which is an inquiry-based, creative kindergarten play-based program. There is a Reggio school in Rochester at the Strong. It's a preschool, and they are moving into kindergarten with Reggio, which is really very encouraging. And it's the bottom line is developmentally appropriate. It's what kids are all about, and the focus of it really is capsulized in the Fred Rogers quote that you started out with. I mean, that's what it's all about. Play is the work of children. And children's executive function, their ability to problem solve, to get along with each other, to be social, develops at this early age, and it is absolutely necessary that that's what we're doing in kindergarten, grades 1 and 2, instead of trying to bring 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade concepts into kindergarten and expect kids to fill in bubble tests, about which they have no idea. They're just going through these activities by rote because they have no idea what they're doing.
The last question on standardized tests that I intend to ask, and the listeners, look, if you want to land on this too, as it relates to education, especially at these younger ages, you can do that. But, Bill, I saw the Obama administration said they want to see testing no more than 2% of the time that a child is spending in a year. I did a little math. You know, we're talking, you know, dozens of hours.
24 hours of time. Again, very ill-advised. You know, that's all smoke and mirrors.
Why is it smoke and mirrors?
Because it's 24 hours. It's actually, it's an insane amount of testing. Especially for the primary grades, there are people who are looking into this that don't understand education and how it's delivered. It's not just the 24 hours of testing that the 2% represents. It's all of the preparation, all of the test prep that goes into the 24 hours of testing. So if you have 2% of testing, your year is going to be 2% of testing. Your entire focus is going to be on testing because you're in order to.
Even though 98% is not spent taking tests?
No, that's just the 2% is the time that you're sitting down taking the tests. Your whole focus now is to. And also tying the tests into a system where you're punished if the school is punished, the kid's punished. If they don't do well on it, it turns it into high stakes. So you run into this problem of not only of the 2%, but you also run into the problem of all of the preparation for the 2%.
Okay, and go ahead, Dr. Gilbert. I know you want to jump in as well.
Well, I think you need to add some of the very good research that's been done at the University of Rochester over a long period of time to speak to this issue of what testing can do, what early academic training can do. Quite a long time ago, a developmental psychologist, David Elkind, wrote about the hurried child. And he did a very effective job of taking a theory of cognitive development and showing what is a child ready for. And we have found that, yes, you can enforce or force children to learn more quickly. But what is lost is a intrinsic motivation to do the learning. The child accommodates, the child does what he or she is told, but the learning is not active. It is very passive. And then there is the testing that begins to be perceived as punitive, as a threat. Another whole series of research that's been done over 3 decades is self-determination theory, which suggests that children can sustain an effort to learn if they feel some sense of independence, competence, and relationships that are empathic. This is not happening in many public schools. There are some wonderful teachers who believe in this and fight the system and do well for their children. But institutionally, it's not really happening on a regular basis.
All right, listeners, if you want to join the program, I want to hear from you about what you expect for your kids' schools when it comes to play-based learning, what you are seeing now. If you want to talk about homework, testing, et cetera, and how that impacts the possibility of play-based learning, et cetera, call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Joel listening says, see John Oliver's recent segment online about standardized testing. And by the way, Bill should be the next Rochester superintendent. There's an opening.
There you go. I was waiting for that to come up.
That's a big no, Bill. He's staying in retirement?
Oh, no, I'm not eliminating anything at this point.
Oh, you're not?
No. No, I'm keeping the...
Are you interested in that job?
I'm not closing the door.
Come on, you're not running for office. You're not a politician.
No, I'm not closing the door.
All right, that's fair.
If I were a politician, I would just give you a non-answer.
Yeah,
I'm telling you that this is I'm really very tired of seeing what has happened to the city over the last 15 years, and we really need to be looking at what really works, what is evidence-based, what is developmentally appropriate. That's not happening right now, and that's something I'm very interested in.
Have you been approached about the job?
Not really. I've had conversations with people, but to say I've been approached by it, I think that would probably be a stretch.
Okay, and just to close the loop on the 2% thing, because for our listeners who weren't familiar with that, I mean, that was pretty new in the last month. It sounded, the way the New Yorker characterized it, the Obama administration was echoing some almost remorse about the level of testing, and they want to get it back down to 2% or less. Is there a number in your mind? How many hours a year is acceptable to you, Bill?
No, I don't think you could quantify it that way. So that's the problem, because when you try to quantify something that is not quantifiable as to what should be happening in an individual class, each class needs to look somewhat different based on the students that you have. And the 2% is a very large number, and in some cases more than we're doing right now. And the fact that President Obama appointed John King as the Secretary of Education pretty much shows me that there really it's business as usual, because this is a guy that was run out of New York State for exactly these reasons, for overtesting and everything that's attached with that.
The conference coming up on Wednesday, and Melanie Moroz, who is your focus on who should be attending this conference coming up on Wednesday? And again, it's 9 to noon at the Strong Museum of Play. It's the 9th annual Urban Suburban Conference on Play Equals Learning Equals Play. Who's it targeted for?
I think that we're really targeting anyone who's involved with children. Educators, of course, parents, grandparents, people in the community who care about children, daycare providers would be a great target for us, people in social service agencies who work with children. Because play is important in the schools, but it's also important in other areas of children's lives, too. And if you think about kids now there's kids who are living in unsafe neighborhoods who aren't playing outside and having free play experiences, and there's kids in affluent suburban communities who don't get a chance for free play either because they're rushed from activity to activity. And you think about in generations past, every kid was a free range kid. In the summer, your parents would kick you out the door in the morning and say, come home for lunch and for dinner, and the kids were all together.
Yes, they'd be in jail now for that.
Exactly, exactly, or certainly investigated. But kids used to learn so much by just being together. They were able to grow socially and emotionally and create their own senses of safety. They looked out for one another. And now we have kids who are in activities who are either... they're coached, they're officiated, the kids always have adults overseeing what they're doing, and they don't have the opportunity to play and have their creative experience and also to develop skills where if kids used to get together and play a game of kickball, they would form the teams. They mm-hmm. would make sure everything was fair. There wasn't an official there or an adult telling them how to do it. And they don't have that opportunity anymore.
Let me grab some of our phone calls, because all of a sudden, almost every phone line is lit up with people who want to talk about these issues. And let me start with Anne-Marie in Rochester first up. Go ahead, Anne-Marie.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like for the panelists to the narrowing focus in our school curricula today. Because the subjects that are not tested are getting a great short shrift in the curriculum, I'm speaking specifically of music, art, drama, visual arts, drama, and dance, the foreign languages, the social studies, and science. I'm a professor of music education, so I'm especially interested in the lack of music education that's happening because of the very fact that schools are focusing on the tested subject. I also want the listeners to be aware that the coolest blow related to the standardized testing of only a few subjects forces teachers who don't teach the tested subjects, specifically language arts and mathematics, to be evaluated on subjects they don't teach and on the test scores of students, some of whom they have never met or had in class.
Anne Marie, thank you. At first, hard to hear, but I think we've got the gist of it. Let me go around the room there.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Anne Marie. Melanie, go ahead.
I spent a lot of time at Nathaniel Rochester Community School in Rochester. It's also known as School 3. It's in the Cornhill neighborhood. And I've seen a lot more art and music in the schools, and the kids are dancing more than there was before Dr. Vargas took over. And I know Dr. Vargas has been subject to a lot of criticism, but at least at this one school, I'm seeing a lot more of that. There used to be one music room. There's multiple music rooms now. And I think that it is getting more respect.
You know, Melanie, it's interesting you say that, because when he was on this program before it was announced he was leaving, he really stressed the value of music in education, not just to learn a piano, but the way it impacts your brain. We've talked about that here. And it's always hard to tell if people are giving you lip service, but he seemed very genuine about it. You're saying you've seen, at least from what your own experience is, in some places you've seen that?
I have, and I've also experienced teachers who, when the kids come in the morning, they're playing classical music in their classrooms in the city schools when the kids enter the building. And it has a great effect on the kids.
Bill, are you buying it?
I'm very happy to hear what Melanie is saying. However, what is happening across the board is that kids who are tested and they're low in ELA, they're low in math, they'll receive double ELA, they'll receive double math, and I have seen entire schedules, elementary schedules, where there is no social studies in the schedule, where there is no science in the schedule, where there's no music, where there's no art, because kids are taking twice the amount of ELA and twice the amount of math. So that's unfortunately happening. So not only are kids in many circumstances missing out on the arts, music and art, but they're also missing out on staple core subjects like science and social studies.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones. And this is Barb in the city of Rochester. Go ahead, Barb.
Yes. Is that me?
Yes, go ahead.
I've been listening to the program and finding it very entertaining and informative. However, as a past speech and language pathologist with the city school district, I have found, and others have found, that, and I haven't heard any indication about the importance of speech and language development in these students. You're not going to see reading happening or taking tests or even knowing how to take a test until they have appropriate speech and language skills. And that's paramount, in my belief, that these kids are going to succeed. If you're going to succeed with reading and writing and doing math, you need to know the concepts. And you need to know the language behind it. And if they're not given language skills, they're not going to achieve the other skills. So basic language and speech skills are probably paramount over anything else, especially when you're talking about pre-K and kindergarten students.
Okay, Barb.
And that's my opinion.
Barb, stand on.
I'm sticking to it.
Can you stay on the line, please? Thanks for the phone call, Barb. Stay there. Let's let our panelists respond.
Certainly.
Go ahead.
Well, I think the importance of communicating and being articulate, of course, I totally agree with the person who phoned in. One of the beauties of Generation 2 is that what grows out of the play is conversation, and there is a freedom for the child to express himself or herself. And it's connected to play, but the conversations become fascinating in that the child is learning to disclose what is on his mind or what is on her mind. And that experimental way of talking about oneself, I think, is a good foundation for the other training that's needed. You know, we complement or support the kind of educational training that breeds skills, but we do it in the freedom of a child-centered play.
Okay, Melanie?
I'd like to add to Bruce's comments that for children in schools, they don't have time to develop these relationships with one adult except in this experience that they have with us. Most kids, unless they have some kind of a deficit or a special need or in some kind of crisis, don't get a half hour of one-on-one time with an adult. So they don't have a half hour where they can talk to anyone. The teacher never has a half hour with each child individually. And they're getting this every week through the experience they're having with in play and conversation with an adult who cares about them. So these relationships become very, very strong and very, very important to the children.
Bill?
We shouldn't fall into the trap that teaching language skills and speech and play are mutually exclusive. This is the trap that so many people fall into. They think that play is this add-on. Play is the vehicle. Today, I was in a kindergarten class. I was on the floor, on a rug, in Fairport at Dudley School, in a kindergarten class, with children, playing with them, but that play doesn't happen in a vacuum, in silence. I'm having conversations with 12 children today, all 12 children, and speech and language is paramount through the play. We can't look at these things as being mutually exclusive.
All right, Barbara, what do you make of what you just heard there?
I'm sorry?
What do you make of that? Does that change your view at all, or does that supplement some of the point you're making?
I'm looking at it more in terms of concept development. For example, if you're taking a test and the child doesn't know over, under, how is he going to perceive that on a test question, even as little as that, if they don't know what over and under means?
The generalization
of concepts is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you learn concepts.
When I was working in the school district, it was put upon me to teach the concepts and to teach the differences in value systems of numbers and letters and recognition of numbers and letters, even before that child had an opportunity to look at it on a piece of paper.
All right, Barb, thanks for the phone call. Bill, go ahead.
All of those, just oddly enough, that's exactly what we were talking about today as we're stacking cups about over and under. All of these concepts happen and are taught in a very different way, but we should not be in kindergarten, by any stretch of the imagination, be emphasizing paper tests. And there are there's plenty of research to back this. I mean, I'm talking 80 years of research about the inappropriateness of having pen and paper tests in kindergarten.
But maybe related, Bill, tell me if I'm wrong here. I feel like I've heard you say that we overemphasize when kids should be reading and writing at an earlier age.
Absolutely.
You think we do?
Yeah, I think we need. Again, if we look at the research, and there's plenty of it. There's one particular study in New Zealand where they took 5-year-olds and taught them how to read, and started teaching formal reading lessons at 5-year-old, and then a control group of 7-year-olds. Well, when they both groups were at 11, there's no difference in the reading levels, but the difference is that the kids who started early reading instruction at 11 years old hated reading, where the kids who started at 7 years old didn't hate reading, they actually loved reading. So there's this, the whole issue that Bruce was talking, hinted on earlier about readiness and developmental readiness, this is very important.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to get a short break in, and if you're waiting on the phones, we've got a lot more to come here. Mitchell, Paul, and more, we're going to get to you. Mike and Irondequoit will be coming to you as well. But this is what we'll go to break with. Here's an email from Catherine that I think helps us answer another question here. Catherine says, bravo for the focus on the importance of play, even for older elementary kids.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about, we often talk about pre-K, 3-4 years old, the Reggio approach, but then it kind of goes away the older kids get. And Catherine writes to us and says, as a retired Rochester City School District teacher, I know from experience that the amount of time spent preparing for tests and remediating is way more than 2%. When the majority of students are performing below standards, New York State requires weekly and monthly progress monitoring, which takes away from instructional time. On top of that, Rochester had its own sets of tests that were administered in addition to New York State testing. And she is saying, look, we can't just talk about it at a pre-K level, that this kind of unstructured time, that playtime has value. So let's get a short break in. And the next question for the panel is, you know, how do we moderate that as we get older? Or what do we do the older kids get? Let's get a short break in and we'll ask that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, money in politics. Some argue that money dominates politics, particularly political campaigns. The League of Women Voters wants to talk about it. We'll preview an event they have, and we'll talk about money in politics and what might change the current scenario. Then second hour, we'll talk to Lauren Acampora, the author of The Wonder Garden. Writers and Books is bringing her to Rochester in the debut novel series.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Jiva Theater Center, presenting The Lion, a musical about love, loss, family loyalty, and the redemptive power of music, featuring writer-performer Benjamin Scheuer through November 22nd. Details and tickets online at jivatheater.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. About 13 years ago, our guests today got together to help create Generation 2, and Dr. Bruce Gilberg, founder of Generation 2. Again, for our audience just joining us, what's the short description of what Generation 2 is?
Generation 2 is an intergenerational experience relying on child-centered play that builds a relationship that focuses on a child's need to speak out, create without dire consequences. We're also a child advocacy organization. Just before we cut away, there was talk about older children prospering from play.
Yes.
And before we get to older children, I'd like to say that our volunteers, which range from either a number of 80 to 150 strong, depending on the year, they also prosper from play. And when they're with their G2 friends, there's a joyfulness and a spirit and a sense of purpose in their time. We have over 80 to 85% return rate with our volunteers because I think there's something very meaningful in the play for them. The other thing is I mentioned child advocacy, and through Generation 2, we have what's called the Please Play campaign. And we ask parents and caretakers, grandparents, to be able to dedicate 20 minutes a week to sit down on the floor and respond to their child's playfulness. And we're finding that very often in a very busy life, in a very sometimes confusing life, it's very hard for people to sit, be still, and receive what the child is doing. Now, as far as older children prospering from play, as we move along, there seems to be more and more organized or structured play and very little free play. That's a problem. Because if you don't fit on a baseball team or a basketball team or a swim team, you can actually feel marginalized. And going out in your backyard or getting a bunch of children to play together becomes a very cumbersome activity. It's not natural and spontaneous. So a lot of children start to experience the play that's available to them as only competitive, very demanding, and that the expectations are that they're going to be very good at it rather than the nature of play that we're discussing, which is that there are no dire consequences.
So G2 and has been saying it's not just about what happens in school, that at home it matters. And wherever kids are, play matters. And I think that point's well taken. That's part of the upcoming conference this coming Wednesday from 9 to noon, the 9th annual Urban-Suburban Conference, Play Equals Learning Equals Play, presented by G2. That's at the Strong National Museum of Play, and you can contact Dr. Bruce Gilbert if you want to attend or if you know someone you think should attend. But let me just go around the table and ask. Let's talk about the school setting then. We're not talking pre-K anymore. You get into first, second, third, fourth grade. What could schools do to make sure that physical activity is not just if you play on a sports team, if you, you know, do certain things that are more structured? Bill Calla, what could be done?
Well, I think, the book, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, this really applies at all age levels. There has to be, in every single class, and I have preached this for now 20 years, every single class should empower kids in a way that there is fun in a classroom, freedom, student power to have control over their own learning and lives, and love. There has to be a love in the classroom between the teacher and the student and the student and the teacher. Those are like the four critical elements of every classroom. And that fun, I always mention first. When I interview and I hire teachers and I hire administrators, I always have a question where I ask them about, what do you do for fun? What does fun mean to you? And again, the issue of not being so competitive, whereas we look at athletics or all of the other competitive activities, which I think is a stretch in many cases to call them fun. Yeah, it's where activities are student-centered, where they're initiated by the students, they, I think those kinds of activities help define what we mean by fun. I want to go on a couple of thoughts that were mentioned here today, but the reduction of play has had a very serious impact on mental health of children and adults. There are some very good research that has been popping up lately, longitudinal 30-year research about when play is extracted from childhood, what happens to the adult? What does the adult look like of a child who hasn't had play? And they're doing some pretty interesting studies on this. And really, what we're seeing is that when children have lived a life in absence of play, of free play, that the social-emotional issues in their lives are quite dramatic, and they experience some serious mental health issues. And what we're finding, and I have this 45-year perspective in public education, is that we are seeing more mental health issues in schools now than we have ever seen before. And I've had conversations with Bruce, and Bruce is a clinical psychologist, has his own clientele, and Bruce could address that issue. But the psychologists that I've been speaking with have seen a massive increase in mental health issues. And a lot of it relates to the direction that school has taken.
I want to get back to the phones because every single phone line is taken up, and I want to clear some space if any others want to jump into the conversation. Mike in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Mike.
Hello. What a fascinating conversation. Pardon me. And even as adults, we have a great need for play. But I remember a quote, and I wish I could remember who said it, but it was, if technology is the measure of man's intelligence, then the arts are the measure of his humanity. Mm. And we seem to be cutting that out. And I think it's going to be, as Mr. Calla pointed out, to the detriment of a whole generation of adults. I see what is happening with all of the testing and the rating teachers as a way of and also cutting budgets as a way of starving our schools into failure to justify a mass privatization. And I'll take your answers off the air.
Thank you, Mike.
I couldn't agree more. He said it perfectly.
One of the things about Generation 2 is that we include all children in a classroom. We don't use testing or identify children at risk. We avoid the stigma of taking some children for this experience and leaving others out. And we address the humanity of these children by emphasizing paying attention to them and accepting them. And I think Bill mentioned a word that is rarely used in education, which is love. And we find that our volunteers love the children, accept them, and learn from them. In a way, the children become the adult, the mentors to the adults. And through discussion groups every week, there's this conversation about what is healthy and vital about what the children are doing every week.
Go ahead, Melanie.
I'd like to add to what Bruce said, that the children also love the volunteers. And they rush into the room with hugs for their friends. And they really thrive on that one-to-one relationship and the time that they're spending together. And it's not just that 30 minutes a week that's so powerful during that year of kindergarten or first grade that they have this experience, but this relationship persists as long as the children are in the school. They still see these volunteers if they're in the building, and they eighth graders rush up to these people who played with them 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, and they still want to have that connection with them on a weekly basis.
If I could add to that, you know, we've been talking a lot about play today, but the second prong of this initiative is the intergenerational part of it that Melanie brings up. There is such a bond and such a love between the young child and our senior volunteers. It's just incredible. And again, there is an enormous amount of research on the value of intergenerational activities. And this is, I wanted to make sure that we highlight that this is not just about play. It is about play, but it's also about that intergenerational aspect of it.
And we often hear from the volunteers that they might have had a bad week or a bad day, and they don't really feel like coming in. And they come in anyway because they've made this commitment, and they leave feeling like $1 million because they've had such a good time with the kids, and it's changed their entire outlook.
We're getting absolutely swamped with feedback from the phones to email. And so, listeners, we're going to spend the rest of the hour taking your comments for our panel as we talk about play. But if you want to attend, or you know someone who you think you'd like to attend the upcoming conference this coming Wednesday at the Strong National Museum of Play from 9 to noon, you can do that, and you can contact Dr. Bruce Gilbert, who's the founder of G2 that is putting on this conference, and we'll make sure you've got that contact info at the end of the show. We'll also put it up on our podcast when we podcast this program this afternoon on our website. Back to the phones, and Paul in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Paul.
Good afternoon. Thank you for a truly excellent discussion. This idea of the difference between play and what educators like to call learning is an unnecessary dichotomy. Some of the best learning happens while playing. The best language development, the best interpersonal skills, the creation of all sorts of things, a creation of little pieces of art and little pieces of theater that kids do at a young age while playing. The trick seems to me, especially when the kids get a little older, perhaps late elementary and early middle school, is to conceive activities that allow that combination, that foster the use of language and the use of music and the use of art in ways that bring the kids together with volunteers, that bring the kids together with each other, that create new opportunities for expression. And you'll get more so-called skill building that way than you will with all the drill of adverbs and nouns and so forth that teachers seem to never get enough of. I'm, by the way, a 30-some-odd-year retired teacher, but I'm also the director of numerous shows, and shows where kids often wrote some of the material by interacting with each other and creating the show as they went along. So I'd be interested in your guest comment on that interplay.
Thanks very much for the call, Paul. Thoughts on that, Dr. Gilberg?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on designing educational programs that permit a continuation of a playful discovery of life. However, if we start early and we don't dampen curiosity and a search for novelty, there will be children who are interested in music opportunities or art opportunities because it stimulates them. What I'm concerned about is where expectation replaces empathy and playfulness is replaced by a seriousness to be prepared for high school, be prepared for college. In my practice, I often meet up with 6-, 7-, 8-year-olds who think that if they're not doing well in reading or writing, that it's going to go on their permanent record and they're going to have problems getting into college. And we have to move children back to the importance of being 8 or 12 all through their curiosity about their life.
Go ahead, Bill.
Hitchhiking on that, we have a problem with understanding the here and now. And the here and now is very important. A 5-year-old, we should be doing everything to make 5 a glorious year. We should be doing everything to make 6 a glorious year, not drilling into their heads that, wait a minute, in order for you to be college and career ready, we're going to have to prepare you in such a way that you're able to take a test next year. And this is something that I've preached for years, is that let's focus on the here and now and the beauty of the age that we're in, instead of always having someone look to that next year and where they perceive themselves as capable and not academically prepared for the next year. Let's, again, focus on the here and now.
Let me go back to our listeners. Eric writes to the program, "It seems to me that we'll only preserve recess and playtime if the state can find a way to create a standardized test for it." That's from Eric. Mary writes to the program and says, "Great show today. Thanks for the hard work bringing these kind of conversations to the community. The panel are providing some of the most grounded, balanced texture to education that I've heard in a long time, and their insight into play, curricula, and testing are accurate and refreshing." That's a couple of perspectives from our listeners. And Mitchell in Rochester has been waiting. Go ahead, Mitchell.
I also want to thank the panelists for the really great work that they're doing. G2 sounds like a really wonderful program, and I'm wondering, how can the people in the Rochester area volunteer with this program or help the program grow?
You know, just as I heard the last caller call in, that's the first thing that ran into my mind. Is that, okay, these people would be wonderful volunteers for G2. They would be wonderful.
Do you need volunteers?
We always need volunteers. Melanie.
Yeah.
I think the best way to get in touch with us is to possibly go through our website, which is g2rochester.org, or to contact Bruce Gilberg at his email.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
BruceGilberg@gmail.com.
And it's GILBERG, BruceGilberg@gmail.com, if you want to do that. That's great. Again, we've been talking this hour about how play benefits everybody who's actually doing
it. Absolutely.
We would love to grow our programs, and the way to do that is through more volunteers.
Let me get back to the phones, and Josh has been waiting. Go ahead, Josh.
Hi. So I'll get right to it. I'm an educator. I teach college-level military science. My wife's an educator, teaches elementary school art. They seem like they're, you know, maybe a little opposed, but one of the things we have in common is that our students get the most out of the experiences that we give them, maybe a leadership lab from me or completing a project from my wife's students. Is experience maybe a better word to use than play to really get the full picture of what children and students are getting out of it, rather than just saying play? Is play a biased word and experience maybe wraps it up a little bit better?
It's an interesting question. If play has become sort of a pejorative, it shouldn't be, but maybe, I mean, that's an interesting point. What do you think? Let's ask the panel. What do you think?
Hearing the term just play disturbs me.
But yeah, I understand the point he's making, though. Some people's perception of that play is empty. And then maybe that's part of why we're having these conversations.
I think kids can learn as much from playing as they can from any academic presentation that they get in school.
At what age, though, does that start to turn? Does that turn?
I don't think it ever turns.
No, we should be playful at work. If we're not joyful and happy at work, we're not going to be as productive as we want to be. One of the reasons that we do what we do and that we're involved in G2 is really to help define the word play. And if there is a pejorative, it's very sad if there's a pejorative connotation to the word play. And I think that's just the direction that we've gone in this world, which is very sad. So we're here to refine the definition of play and the and really highlight the value of play.
I think the caller brings up an important point in that it's the experience of play, not the talking about play, that is what G2 is all about, and other types of free play that go on through children's lives. It is experience. It is action-oriented. It is mobilizing. And those qualities are what breed vitality or health in a child.
Maureen writes to the program and says, as a recently retired kindergarten teacher, I just want to chime in on testing in kindergarten. Bubble tests with the Common Core unit tests are bubble tests with smiles and frowns. I have many students who see smiles and frowns as behavior mod symbols. They would never circle a frown. Also, one of my brightest girls once filled in her bubble sheet and said to me when I collected it, look, I made a pattern. Smile, frown, smile, frown. These children are not ready for this type of assessment. Also, at the end of the year, I had completed the units required, and I dumped out 2 bags of dress-up materials and just let the children play. They were so excited and asked daily if we could do that again. That's from Maureen. I wasn't aware of the whole bubble testing smiles and frowns thing in kindergarten, but Bill, any thoughts about that?
Oh, well, I've done my best to make sure that we eliminate bubble testing in kindergarten because literally, as the caller, as Maureen had mentioned, it's that they really don't even know what they're doing. This is just rote activity. And I think if you really understand developmentally where kids are, you know that that's really meaningless. And the emphasis that we've been placing on Reggio Emilia play-based learning, it really takes the dress-up clothes out of the closet and puts them into the classroom. It's not just this add-on that what has happened over the years is that teachers have been forced to put their dress-up clothes in the closet. They've been forced to put the easels in the closet. They've been forced to put a cover over the sand table. These are things that need to be in the classroom. The art easels need to be in the center of the classroom along with the markers and the scissors for easy access, with the blocks, with the stacking cups, with all of this play-based material readily accessible to kids.
Barry writes to us and says, play and fun are often connected with the term recreation. Recreation can also be understood as recreation. That is an ongoing process of creation. We should be creators. We should be creating, and that is what makes us human. Recreation for adults may take us away from our routine, allow us to rebuild ourselves. In that case, we can return to our routine refreshed and maybe more open to things we weren't when we were run down by life in the day-to-day. Recreation for children is part of their normal process of development. Physical, mental, and social development, we must provide time for this in our schools. That's from Barry. And I'm seeing a lot of nods around the table. I'll try to sneak in one more quick phone call. And this is, I think it's Law in Rochester. Go ahead.
I am absolutely blown away by this conversation. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I'm an educator myself. I'm an improv theater professor at SUNY Brockport. I used to teach at School of the Arts. And I mean, people are still surprised by these things. That's what kills me, to listen to folks that are like, wow, this seems like a good idea. Like, we fought these battles. Viola Spolin was doing this stuff during the Depression in Chicago. Kids have been playing and learning effectively for ever. And I cannot, it's so sad that we have to still learn these things. I guess I want to just throw in, Viola Spolin's a big one for me. And she just said, nobody teaches anybody anything. It's all experience. It's all getting on your feet and doing. Mm. And that's just so huge, man. So thank you so much for your work. You guys are going to hear from me as far as being a volunteer. I helped create the Arts Integrated program here in the city that was disseminated throughout the city schools for sixth grade English language arts to put theater into it. And it was like a big mystery. So, well, how are we going to do this? We're going to do it, man. We've got to do it. As far as creating those things, there's a lot of us out here that want to help do that, so I can't wait to be a part of that.
Well, thanks for the phone call, Law, and you can feel the enthusiasm just pouring over the phones. I've got about a minute left, and on his point that he's making about, you know, how you're going to fit in time for theater, et cetera, I had an email from someone earlier this hour who said, why isn't, you know, art and music and theater, why aren't they core subjects? Why don't we treat them just as important as others? Bill, would you?
Absolutely. You know, We've had robotics in Fairport, mm-hmm. and it was an add-on. It was an after-school, and there was such enthusiasm for this, such by the kids, that we need to make this part of the curriculum. We need to make it an offering, and that's what we did. And that's what we need to do. That's what we need to do with the arts, with music, that it needs to be integral to the
school. Okay, 20 seconds, Bruce. Go ahead.
Generation 2 is on the move. We've been careful to stay small until we have our programs at the highest quality. But our goal is to cross demographics, to be in many schools. We believe children can make a difference in their own lives if we pay attention to them and accept them. And we believe that children can also bring us together.
Well, if you want to contact Bruce, you can do that. Bruce Gilberg is the founder of G2, Generation 2, and they are presenting the 9th Annual Urban Suburban Conference. Play equals learning equals play. It's this coming Wednesday from 9 to noon at the Strong National Museum of Play. You can contact Bruce at this number, 585-244-5970. 244-5970. The easy email is brucegilberg@gmail.com if you want to attend on Wednesday. Thanks for being here, Bruce. Nice talking to you. Melanie Moroz is the executive director of G2. Nice having you, Melanie. Bill Calla, nice having you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks for taking the time, and we'll have much more to talk about on these subjects and more. Thanks for listening all week. John Andrus engineering the program today. The producer of Connections is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm the host, and I'll talk to you on a Monday.